In an effort to lessen distractions to others and respect our speakers, we ask that you please take a moment before to silence and put away your cell phones and other electronic devices. In addition, we ask that you only have kosher-approved food and drink to respect our hosts, the temple. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Beacon Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship who share their strength, experience, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement to membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institutions. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The Beacon Group insists on providing a safe and effective meeting place so all who wish to recover from alcoholism. Therefore, we ask all attendees to foster a secure and welcoming environment, refraining from any behavior that might compromise another's safety. As our traditions remind us, our common welfare is paramount. Each member of Alcoholics Anonymous is but a small part of the great whole. For more information about safety in AA, see the AA safety card and safety and AA our common welfare. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Socrates will now read the steps.
Socrates, alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs.
Thank you, Socrates. The format of this meeting is a 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. All our meetings are recorded and accessible on our website, beacongroupaa.com. We support AA's statements of unity and anonymity, and therefore ask all our speakers to identify by first name only and refrain from using profanity. Tonight, our first 10-minute speaker is Bruce.
Hey everyone, I'm Bruce. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey Bruce.
It's really great to be here. Thanks to Brian for asking me to speak tonight. Yes, much better. My sobriety date's November 29th, 2012. So, you know, if I get through this month, God willing, I'll have 11 years of sobriety. I owe it all to Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in here an extremely broken down person. I had burned every bridge in my life. Just to back up, like, to identify as an alcoholic, well, the first time I picked up a drink, I don't know, I was 14 or 15, it was like everything changed for me that day. I think the best way I've heard it described as is like, at least the thing that really I related to the most was that it, for me, like, alcohol solved problems that I didn't know that I had, and just introduced so much to my life that, like, I didn't think I could do without it. So, like, the night that I picked up a drink, it was like I was going in one direction before that, like, you know, cared about school, cared about sports and all that, and then I just took a hard right turn and my life became, you know, 100% focused on getting messed up all the time. And yeah, I mean, it alcohol worked for me for a while. I think that if it didn't, I wouldn't be in AA or, you know, whatever. I just would have went and figured out something else. But it worked for me tremendously for quite a few years. And, you know, I experienced consequences right off the bat, like pretty major stuff. Like I had a DUI before I was even 18. So like senior year of high school, already couldn't drive after being able to drive for a couple of months. You know, getting arrested for other things. Medical issues, and I just remember, like, you know, sitting in a hospital or sitting in a court getting arraigned, and the only thing I cared about was, like, am I going to be able to drink again? Like, I didn't care about all the external, like, consequences. It's like, can I get my medicine? And then an unfortunate thing occurred, was alcohol stopped working for me, and, like, good alcoholic, I continued to drink more, drink longer, drink whatever, just like chase that original feeling that I got from it. And, you know, it just led me, you know, this is a progressive illness. I every year got worse than the last, until, yeah, I mean, I had been drinking for well over a decade, and my life was really small. I was drinking around the clock, drinking before work, drinking during work, after work, of course. Yeah, and I would go on these, like, 2, 3, 4 week benders, you know, eventually stop because I just, either an institution would stop me, either, like, the police, or I'd have to go to a hospital or something. You know, I would just have tremendous, you know, physical and mental torture. Have a couple days removed from the drink and be like, yeah, I can't do this anymore. Like, I'm not... At the very least, I'm going to change the way that I drink, but I really just need to stop altogether. And then, you know, that subtle insanity would come back. I'd forget everything that I just went through, and I'd be at it again. So, you know, totally just in the cycle, getting worse, getting worse, getting worse. And, you know, I only have 10 minutes. So eventually that, I found my way into Alcoholics Anonymous. And, yeah, I mean, it was... The thing I remember the most about my first meeting was on a Friday night, and I was in a locked facility up in, you know, up in McLean, because I started finding my way into detoxes a lot towards the end. And, you know, I just remember being really fascinated by the people that came into the meeting that night, because they just seemed like they were doing it of their own free will. They seemed really, they just seemed at ease and content, right? And like, I think in the end, like, at way back at the beginning when I picked up a drink, like, that's what I was chasing. I just wanted that ease that they had, and I was really attracted to that. And, yeah, that started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I started going to meetings, but, you know, I still just had a lot of opinions, a lot of ideas that I didn't want to let go of. Certainly one of them... being the whole God thing and the higher power. And I, you know, I can read ahead here, and I remember sitting in a meeting and looking at, like, step 4 and 5 and 8 and 9, just go, thank you, and just going, nope, that is not for me. So not in a million years. And yeah, eventually I just, like, thought my way out of the meetings, right? Like, I was like, I can handle this. I had, you know, put together longer than I ever had before, you know, months of continued sobriety. I didn't realize it at the time, but it was obviously a dry drunk. I was white knuckling it. I was insane, and acting no different than I had, other than the fact that I just wasn't in a blackout or in a coma a lot than I was, you know, when I was in active alcoholism. And yeah, I walked out of a meeting and eventually picked up again, and it was, you know, just so much worse than it even had been prior to that, that I went back to detox. And I just remember thinking, like, I only have one shot left. Those people in AA, they were talking about stuff that I wasn't willing to do. So I need to go back there and try that. And if not, I, you know, who knows what would have happened. But thankfully, I just had the willingness. And I went into a meeting. It was a Monday night meeting called Unity over in Somerville. And I raised my hand and just said, I do not know what to do. And yeah, the Miracle Day took over. A bunch of people, a bunch of men came up to me and introduced me to my, what would be my home group for many years, called Knuckleheads over in Somerville. I was met on a Tuesday then. They meet on Thursdays now. It's still a good meeting. And it was a solution-based meeting, right? And the guys were talking about doing the work, and they had sponsors, and they were active in the group. They went on commitments on weekend nights, and, I just had so much willingness at the time that I couldn't, my ego and, like, my self-will just, like, couldn't reinsert itself because I was so busy doing all the things people suggested. And, you know, I started doing the work with a sponsor, and, you know, I can't explain how it happened, but just one day, I think it was probably around, you know, right in the fourth, or maybe after I did my fifth, I don't really remember, but I just thought to myself, I haven't thought about drinking in a long time. It had been weeks, and that was a miracle, and I couldn't explain it, but I just kept doing the thing, and I'm, you know, tremendously grateful to that group, and, you know, just the message in AA that, like, the steps are the solution, right? Like, you know, I've gone through the steps a couple times since then. I'm going through them again now, writing the fourth step as we speak. I'm starting to understand them a little bit more, starting to understand, like, that, you know, my spiritual sickness, the thing that, you know, made me chase this, to get out of my own head, was that I was just simply incapable of handling life, like, just as it is, like it is tonight in this room. I couldn't deal with that. I could never deal with life on life's terms. And, as I started to understand the work a little better, I realized that, like, you know, these resentments that I'm carrying around, living in the past, you know, revisiting all these things that I'm mad about, are angry with, and, of course, never seeing my side of any of it. So Alcoholics Anonymous and the fourth step and fifth step introduced this way to, like, see the world in a different way outside of my own, like, you know, linear path. Revolutionary. Never would have come up with that on my own. And, you know, it really just eased a lot of, like, the hatred I had for a lot of people. Thanks, and I'll start to wrap up. And, I believe, like, continuing to work the steps is, like, my only chance of, like, living a life that's second to none. Like, I've had all these wonderful things come into my life as a result of AA. Me and my wife had our first kid. She'll be one next Wednesday. She's, like, the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. And I thank AA for all that, but, like, I also use AA to be a better father, because having a baby, as amazing as it has been, has introduced a whole new world of, like, selfishness that, you know, when it's 3 a.m. and she's not sleeping, I get really irritated. So I'm so grateful to have sponsorship and, you know, talk to other guys in the program that are dads, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to speak tonight. It seems like a wonderful meeting, and I'm looking forward to hear the other speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Bruce. We will now observe the seventh tradition. The seventh tradition states, every AA group ought to be self-supporting, declining outside contributions. We are passing the basket, but you may also observe the seventh tradition digitally on Venmo. There is a QR code in the basket, and our Venmo handle is @beacon-group. Although there are no dues or fees for AA membership, we do have expenses. Our rent is $200 per month. Please give what you can and see our treasurer, Ramiro, with any questions. We thank you in advance for your generosity. AA also has a set of traditions, which apply to the group in the same manner that the 12 steps apply to the individual. Tonight, Lori has been asked to read the 12 traditions.
Just this bit. Yeah. Lori, alcoholic. 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain the personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you. Being a group is run by a business meeting, which meets on the third Wednesday of each month directly after the meeting, in person and online. This is your opportunity to get more involved. All group members are encouraged to attend and participate. We hope you can join us. Will all group members please raise their hands? All right. And now let's welcome our second 10-minute speaker, Aria.
Hi, Aria Alcoholic. Yeah. I always get nervous before speaking, so sometimes if I just name it, I get less nervous. Okay. So like I said, my name's Aria and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 27th, 2015. So I just recently got 8 years of sobriety. I have a sponsor. I sponsor anyone regardless of gender. I have two sponsees right now, one of which celebrated 3 years today, which is very exciting for her. I've done the steps, and I continue to try to incorporate them into my life. So I came into the rooms because the city of Boston decided they didn't want their librarians drinking all day at the library. So it was very rude of them, but that's why I'm here. To start off, I grew up here in Boston. I wouldn't consider my household an alcoholic home, but I would qualify for a sister program. My household was just like, it was very chaotic. And I always felt like my parents were very much focused on what my older brother, he has a lot of stuff going on. And so it just always felt like they were focused on him and not. I felt a pressure to like just be okay. So I pretended to be okay despite not being okay. And I just sort of dealt with that by dissociating and then drinking. Around 14, 15, I also had some trauma in my life, and it was just like another reason to drink. I was a blackout drinker from the start, and that didn't scare me at all. I thought that was normal. I actually didn't realize that people don't regularly black out until I came into AA. So I decided that I needed to get out of Boston, moved to New York, lived there for about 10 years. Towards the end of my time there, just nobody wanted to deal with me anymore. I would was the worst roommate. I would leave the door open, would pass out with the stove on. It was just like, it was a nightmare. And I hurt a lot of people I cared about. And so I had to come home. And instead of being honest about why I was moving home, I told, well, so I have an older brother, like I mentioned. I also have a younger brother who's one of us. And about that, around that time, his addiction was getting to the point where he was going to rehab. So I was like, oh, okay, I'll just tell everybody that I'm going home to like help my family deal with this issue of my brother. When it was really just, that was a complete lie. And I was no help. I only made things worse, honestly. And so I moved home and I started my master's degree in New York, and I finished it here. And I started working for the library pretty soon after I graduated. And those were things that really, I feel like, kept me out of the program for a while, because like, I couldn't be an alcoholic. I have a master's degree. I work at the Boston Public Library. It was just like, I had all of these, those were honestly the only things I really had left. I didn't have relationships with my best friend. I didn't really have a relationship with my family. My health was a mess. I got a letter from my doctor saying that my liver was all messed up, and I just threw it out and didn't call her back. And that's how I dealt with everything. You know, I got bad news, I would just not deal with it. And so when the incident happened, I basically woke up in a bathroom at the library and was asked to leave, and then had a brutal 3 months of going to meetings with Boston Public Library, where, like I said, I'm a blackout drinker, so I don't remember anything from that day. So I had to listen to people recount what happened that day, which is, it was really bad. Once that happened, I was devastated. You know, like, my job was like the only thing, thank you, that I like had. And it was the first time I ever felt, I felt like I had nothing left. And so I reached out to my brother. He had 2 years of sobriety at this point. I'd seen how AA had worked for him, and I was like, tell me what to do. And honestly, I came into AA because I thought that it would help me get my job back. And it didn't. They still fired me. Before I went into that last meeting with the city, where I was gonna like find out what the answer was, I had been working on the steps with my sponsor, and I said, okay, I'm gonna pray to my higher power and pray. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. I was like, this sounds like very appropriately AA. I'm gonna pray to accept whatever the outcome is, even though I really just wanted my job back. I didn't get my job back. And it actually took 5 years for me to accept that outcome. And but I did, you know, and like, I now, I actually soon started working for a wonderful company that I still work for. It's great. But you know, it took me 5 years to realize that like, that was not the worst day of my life. That honestly was the start of the best day of my life, because if I hadn't lost that job, there's no way I would have come into these rooms. Like, that was the only thing I had left. And so losing my job just like completely, it was a gift. And, it was really hard for me to see that until, I did the steps twice. What my life looks like now, you know, I, this program has allowed me to, rebuild relationships. rebuild relationships with friends and family. You know, my best friend was planning an intervention when I was, you know, still out there, and now I'm going to family day for her daughter. Her kids mean everything to me. You know, I am also like working on my health. Like I said, I had a liver problem that I just ignored. And, you know, when I went to the doctor the last time, that didn't exist, you know? I mentioned earlier that I have trauma. I have mental health stuff that I have to, that I also continue to pour, to, you know, self-medicate with alcohol. And, you know, I see a therapist. I do all of the things outside of AA that, for my mental health, to make sure that, like, I have my sobriety in check. I have my mental health in check. And, you know, there's just so many things that I wasn't addressing. And I really needed to just, like, get my head on straight before I could even really start doing that. So, yeah, I'm just grateful for this program, grateful for the wonderful relationships I've met in the rooms and outside. And, yeah, that's it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Aria. We encourage all attendees to participate fully in our meetings and to have a service position. If you would like to be at service, see our jobs coordinator Ramiro after the meeting. And now let's welcome our main speaker, Donnie.
Good evening, guys. My name is Donnie. I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict. And, you know, it's great to be here tonight. Every time I come to this group, you guys are in a different building. You know, and I think this is like the third or fourth that, you know, that I've been to. You know, as I said, I'm an alcoholic. My home group is the Winchester Morningside Group out of Winchester, Mass. We're a Monday evening open speaker meeting. And at 7:30 to 8:30, and we have a beginner's meeting from 6 to 7, and we do serve hot dogs in between. So it is a hot dog meeting. And my sobriety date is December 28, 1998. And I am just so grateful for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you know, the people that have helped me throughout the years. And the most important thing in my life is my recovery. You know, it comes before everything else. It comes before my career, my marriage, my kids, whatever the case may be. Because if I don't have my recovery, I'm going to lose everything. And you hear that all the time, you know, from speakers, at meetings. And, I'm sure a lot of us have asked the question to, you know, ourselves, you know, when did we become alcoholics? And, you know, it's something that, you know, that I would always ask myself. And a number of years ago, my wife and I were helping my dad clean out his house. He was moving. And he had lived in this house for well over 50 years. And he came up out of the basement. He had this little scroll with a ribbon tied around it. And he handed it to me. And I took the ribbon off and I opened it up. It was my diploma from kindergarten. This is like 1957. And so I started reading what the teacher had written. And I began to laugh because what she was describing was an alcoholic. Seriously. You know, the first thing she said was, "Donald is a joy to have in class." Well, of course I am. I'm a people pleaser. I will do anything to make, you know, to please you. You know, anything that I can do so that you accept me as I am. And so this is, you know, this is one thing that I needed to have. And then she goes on to say, you know, he's very sensitive. And he needs very careful handling. You know, I'm extremely sensitive. I'm overly sensitive. And so here's another attribute that she picked up on. And then I'll just end with this. She says, he never intends to do wrong. And when it happens, it is by accident or simply not his fault. You know, so here I am, 6 years old. I'm already pointing the finger around to my classmates. You know, and this is definitely, you know, alcoholic, you know, behaviors, alcoholic thinking. And so I honestly believe that I was an alcoholic long before I ever physically picked up a drink, you know, because I had all these isms going on. You know, I was just full of fear, doubt, insecurity. I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And this is the way I was. And I just didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. You know, I always felt like the outsider, even in my own family. I had two brothers, an older brother and a younger brother. And you know, I just didn't feel like I fit in. You know, the kids in the neighborhood, no. Kids in school, no. So when I did, to be able to, you know, manage this, was I kept that smile on my face. I kept that mask on, and that's all you needed to know. I wasn't going to let you win. You know, so by all outward appearances, I would come across as a well-adjusted kid. The problem is, my insides did not match my outsides. You know, as I said, I'm just full of feared out insecurity. I'm restless, irritable, discontent, and terrified of everyone and everything. And that's the way I went through my early childhood and adolescence. You know, I just kept this mask on, and I was afraid to say anything to anyone, my brothers, my parents, teachers, friends, because I was afraid that you wouldn't understand me. I was afraid that you wouldn't accept me, and I was afraid that you wouldn't like me, and I needed to have these. And so, you know, my whole life, early life, you know, I went through with that mask on, that facade. And I always felt like I was a phony. You know, I was faking my way through life, you know. And if they ever knew who I really was, you know, I wouldn't be accepted, I wouldn't be liked, I wouldn't be understood. And so, you know, when this is a progressive illness, and of course, as I went through my, you know, early years into junior high and high school, things are getting even more difficult, you know, to cope with life on life's terms. So what I did is I immersed myself in sports. And like a good alcoholic, you know, I did this 110%. You know, I just dove into this thing, and because that was my outlet. That was the only thing at this time that was providing me with any kind of relief. You know, so this is what I'm going to do because it made me feel good. And at the end of my high school, career, you know, the sports are now done. I'm going on to college, and so now I'm left, you know, without any kind of defense against me. And innocently enough, a few of us guys, had a few six packs of beer, and we went out into the woods around a barrel fire, and we started drinking the beers, and something magical happened, you know, and I realized that for the first time in my life, I felt okay, you know. First time in my life, you know, I didn't have these fears, these doubts, these insecurities. I could be whoever you wanted me to be, and I could be whoever I wanted to be. You know, and my thought at the time was, this must be the way that everyone feels all the time. And if that's the case, I'm going to do this as often as I can, as often as possible, because this is the way that I want to feel. And I remember making that decision, and I did. You know, and I drank at every opportunity, and this was back in the 60s, late 60s, and drugs are coming on the scene, and I was into that scene as well. And just to show you the progression of the illness is, in a very short order, you know, I went from drinking beer, innocently enough, with a few guys around a barrel fire, and now I'm into the hard alcohol. Because I want to get to that point, to that high, as quickly as possible. And I don't want to be playing around with the beers. I want to go right into the hard alcohol. And I did the same thing with the drugs, too. You know, so somehow I managed to get a college education. And I get out of college, and I get a great job. And I go off all dressed up in the morning in a three-piece suit to play businessman. And in the evenings, you know, I take off that suit and tie, and it's like he's a totally different person. I'm one person during the day, and I'm a totally different person at night. It was like I had two personalities, you know. And I thought I was fooling everyone. You know, maybe in the beginning I was, but eventually the only one that I was fooling was myself. because this is a progressive illness. It's a fatal illness. And again, as time went on, you know, the jackpot started to occur for me. And, you know, I was married, you know, in my 30s, and the disease is progressing. And, you know, she didn't want any more of my BS, so she packed up the baby and she left. And, you know, we split the material assets evenly. She got the inside of the house, I got the outside. And, you know, and that was the end of the marriage. And it was all really due, you know, to my my drinking and drugging. You know, but I wasn't going to stop because I needed the alcohol to get the relief that I needed at the time. It was the only tool that I had to provide me with this relief. And the thought of not drinking was just out of the question. That is out of the question. Because by this point, alcohol was the only solution that I had to all of my problems. It was the solution. So I thought. And so this, you know, behavior continued for, you know, for a good many years. And but it got progressively worse. And, you know, it got to the point where this job that I had for 20 years, you know, it got to the point where, you know, they had had enough of me and they decided it would be best if we parted company. And so I get fired after working for this company for 20 years. And I had moved up through this corporate ladder. And so now I can drink and drug the way that I want to. You know, I don't have anyone looking over my shoulder, and I did. You know, and, you know, so now I'm unemployed, unemployable. I have no money. I have no car. And I'm sleeping on my daddy's couch. And if you're sleeping on your daddy's couch when you're in your mid to late 40s, you can consider yourself homeless because that's where I was. And it was through his kindness and compassion and love for his son that he allowed me to stay there, even though I was still doing the same damage to myself, you know, that I had done previously. And you know, we would have conversations and, you know, he would say, you know, you got to do something. And I would say, I know. But I didn't know what to do. You know, because whenever those feelings and emotions came up, or lack of feelings and emotions arose, you know, I just resorted to my only solution, which was the alcohol. And you know, so there was no life going on. It was just an existence. You know, where my heart and soul used to be was now just a big black empty hole. And it was getting deeper and darker by the day. You know, everything was gone on the inside. There was no light. There was no life. I was just existing from one day to the next, basically to drink and to drug. And, you know, the day came where, you know, I needed relief from whatever was going on. I can't even recall what it was. But, you know, when I went to the only solution that I had, the only survival tool at this point, and I was betrayed. I was betrayed by the only friend I had left. And I didn't get the relief that I was seeking. But what it did do is it provided me with another option. And I was okay with this option. As a matter of fact, I welcomed this option. And I found myself sitting at the edge of the bed. I had loaded 38 to my head. I'm going to take my own life. And I was okay with that. That was the amount of pain that I was in. And... you know, certainly, you know, the world will be better off without me. I didn't want to play this game of life anymore. I'm done with this dance. I want out. And, you know, I came to the next morning and I realized that I was still alive. And I just went on a tear, you know, to end all tears. And, you know, if you had what I wanted, I'm taking it. If you want to do something about it, then go ahead. It's fine with me. And, you know, that's the way I existed for a good many years. And really, really sad. Really sad. And every morning that I would wake up and open my eyes, I'd say, not another day. Please. Not another day. You know, and then, you know, years later, I met my wife. Three Sundays in a row waiting for the liquor store to open. at 11:45. That's where this romance started. And you know, we started seeing each other, and it was just totally insane. For a year and a half, it was just nuts. And she would go off to teach, and she would give me my allowance for the day, and I'd go get my cigarettes and my booze for the day, and maybe I can get two or three drunks in. You know, then she would come home from school, and we'd just finish the job. And so this is the way we were living, you know? And it was just horrible. And so it was December 28, 1998. And I sat up in bed, 3 o'clock in the morning. This is my witching hour, 3 o'clock in the morning. And I sat up in bed and I'm sweating profusely. My heart's pounding out of my chest and my stomach is in a knot. And I need to get a drink. And I start to make my way down to the kitchen. And this thought came into my head and it stopped me in my tracks. And that thought was, Donnie, if you pick up a drink or a drug today, it's going to be your last day here. And I heard that, and I didn't know where it came from, but it caused me pause. And I thought about it for a couple seconds, and then I just continued down to the kitchen. And after a few more steps, you know, again, that same message was, Donnie, if you drink today or drug today, you are going to die today. And, you know, and again, I'm standing there, and I don't know what to do. And it was at this moment that I collapsed to the floor. I had tears streaming down my face, and I was sobbing like a child. And I said the words, please, dear God, help me. I'll do anything to get sober. I don't want to die. And this was that moment of clarity, the grace of God entered my life, that gift of desperation, whatever you want to call it. But this was the moment that I honestly admitted to myself, my innermost self, that I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict, and I can't fix me. God knows I tried. I tried every which way to stop or control my drinking and drugging, and I failed miserably every single time. And at this particular time, I honestly admitted to myself, I need to go get some help or I'm not going to make it through a day. And it was at this time that I picked myself up the floor, and my wife and I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that morning. And that was December 28, 1998. And neither of us have found it necessary to pick up a drink or a drug since. We have the same second of sobriety. That doesn't happen too often. Same second of sobriety. And, you know, and so we come into the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had bounced in and out of these halls for years, and you know, but nothing ever seriously. So this time we come into the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we come into a meeting, and this old timer grabs a hold of me and he says, you know, do the opposite of what you're thinking. And I thought about it for a second. He says, let me explain why. He says, you've been an alcoholic and a drug addict probably most of your life, if not your entire life. All of your thinking and all of your behaviors are alcoholic and drug addicted. This is the way you are wired. You need to do the opposite of what you think. And it made sense to me. It really did make sense to me because I started hearing the suggestions around here. You know, join a group, get a sponsor, go on commitments, get active with your group, get on your knees in the morning, get on your knees at night, you know, ask people for help. I didn't want to do any of those things. None of them. But I was willing to do it. So I had to do the opposite of what I was thinking. So it started with the honesty, admitting to myself that I'm an alcoholic, I'm a drug addict. I came to that conclusion, you know, and I was open-minded to the suggestions that you hear around here, and I was willing to put those into practice. That's how this thing works. Honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And when I started doing these things, my life began to change. My life began to change, and little by slow, the days turned into weeks, the weeks turned into months, and the months turned into years, you know, and things are going great. You know, I finally get another job, and our relationship is going great, and I have some money in my pocket, and we're going to meetings, and life is getting good. Life is getting good. I'm going to meetings. Well, let me say something, and some of you may not like this, but meeting makers don't necessarily make it. Because that's all I was doing, was going to meetings. And it got to the point, you know, one day I'm in my home group and I'm looking around and I said to myself, I'm sick of you people. I'm sick of these Boy Scout banners, church basements. I don't need you people. I've been sober for 3 years. I'm good to go. And this is how powerful the disease of alcoholism is, because at that point when I'm thinking this, you know, that beast is awakened. You know, it's like, oh, now I got him. I'm going to pull him out of AA, get him alone, get him in isolation so I can really start working on him. You know, and what happens, you know, a relapse is not an event. It's a process. It happens over a period of time. The last thing that actually happens in a relapse is the physical taking of the alcohol. So it's all up here in the mind. It all starts very slowly, and you don't even know what's happened. So each day we have to ask ourselves, you know, which direction am I moving today? Am I moving forward in my recovery, or am I sliding backwards to a relapse? Because you're never standing still. Never standing still. So if it's like, I don't need to go to a meeting today. I don't need to call my sponsor today. I'm good to go. Guess which direction are you going? That way. So every day we have to make sure that we know which direction we're going. And I was going that way. And it was at this time that, you know, a fellow from the Dorchester area, you know, who was frequenting our meeting, and we had become friends, and I was the bookie of Winchester, and he was the bookie of Dorchester. So he came up, and he says, Donnie, what's the matter? He knew something was off. And, you know, so I told him what was going on, and he looked at me, and he said, do you know the reasons why you drank and drugged in the first place? And I really couldn't give him an answer. I really couldn't give him an answer. And he says, how long can you hold your breath? All you're doing is holding your breath. Can you hold it another week, another month, a year maybe? The day will come where you're going to need some relief. And the thought of picking up a drink or a drug is going to seem like a good option to you. And that absolutely terrified me. And so what we did was he volunteered to, you know, take me through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is our basic text. You know, if you want to learn about the disease of alcoholism and how we recover from this seemingly helpless state of mind and body, you know, we resort back to our basic text, which is the Big Book. You know, and this is the only literature that we have that has clear-cut directions and instructions as a blueprint for living. You know, and what we did on consecutive Sundays was he would sit down and he would read it to me, line by line, sentence by sentence, paragraph by paragraph, and he would explain it to me so that I understood it. Because I had read this book before, it was right over my head. But when he started breaking it down and explaining it to me, it started to make sense. You know, and I was able to, you know, you know, understand the fact that, you know, step one, I came to the conclusion that I'm powerless over alcohol, drugs, people, places, and things. Dash. My life was unmanageable. My life was unmanageable long before I even picked up a drink or a drug. I came to that conclusion. But it had to be that honest admission to myself before I could understand that. And this is the underlying principle of step one, is honesty. And that allowed me to practice step one. Same thing with step two. I came to the conclusion that only power greater than myself could restore me to wholeness or to sanity. And again, the underlying principle of step two is the belief. I had that belief. I had that hope. And that enabled me to grasp a hold of that concept. And those are the conclusion steps. I made a decision with him on step three, turn my life and my will over the care of God, as I understood him at the time. And I was able to do that. And then I embarked on my inventory, my resentments, my fears, and my harms done. And what I found out in these inventories, I wasn't too happy about. You know, these are the character defects, our shortcomings, our grosser handicaps. The reasons why I drank and drugged in the first place. The reasons why I made such heavy going of life. I had no idea up to this point. And I was able to share those with him, and we had a dialogue going back and forth. I would share, and he would share back with me. And so for the first time in my life, I had a better understanding of who I actually was. What made me tick? And as I said, I wasn't too thrilled about some of the things that I found after going through these inventories. But that's where step 6 and 7 comes in. The companion steps. You know, I'm able to turn these over to the God of my understanding. He's much better equipped to deal with these things than I am. I would have hung on to the wrong ones. I turn all this stuff over to him because I want that transmission line between me and the God of my understanding and my fellows to be clear. And if I keep loading these character defects and shortcomings back into this transmission line, there's going to be no room to get through. So I need to keep that clear. I was able to make my amends to people that I had harmed. Most of them have my same last name. And I continue to do this on a regular basis. Where I need to make an amend, I make an amend. You know, I tried today to live in steps 10, 11, and 12. My maintenance steps. Every day I do a 10-step inventory because I want to keep my finger on my pulse. How am I doing today? You know, do I owe any kind of an amend today? Have I been a decent person today? Have I put someone down today? I need to take care of these things immediately. Because these are the things that will get in my head, and the next thing you know, I got a resentment brewing. Or I got a fear popping up. Or I'm going to lash out and hurt someone. And I can't afford to do that. So I constantly take in an inventory throughout the day. Probably the worst part of my program is prayer and meditation. You know, this I find very difficult. To be able to sit and be quiet, to pray and meditate and listen. And as a result of steps 1 through 11, we have a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening. You know, we get to carry this message to the sick and suffering out there. You know, we're not in the results business. We're in the message delivery business. That's what we do. We deliver the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. We deliver the message of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, the principles, to those that may want to hear. You know, we're paper boys and paper girls for God. We deliver the paper. If they want to read the paper, we'll hang around. We'll go through it with them. If not, we just move on to the next house. That's our job, is to try to help those that are sick and suffering out there. You know, for the past 18 years, my wife and I, every spring, you know, we have a big book workshop group at our house, and we take groups of people through the book. So I make it a point to make sure that I go through the book every year. Every year. And it never fails. Every time that we go through it, there's something else that I find in that book. Or there's something that I had written a note on that now I'm crossing it off because now it means something different. Because as we continue to change, our understanding of our God and of the big book of alcoholics continues to evolve as well. It never ends. It never ends. So why would I stop going through this? It wouldn't make any sense. And every time that I go through this and I learn something else, I have that opportunity to present it to someone else. That may help them. You know, that's my job today. You know, I have a great life today. I have a life that I couldn't have imagined in my wildest, wildest dreams. Seriously. And that dad who let me sleep on his couch when I was homeless, for the past 20 years, my wife and I have been his primary caretaker. In this past year, he turned 102. And before he turned 102, he got very ill. And I had to make the decision, because I'm his caretaker, to bring him home and bring hospice in. I had to sit down with him and tell him that he's dying and that we'll be here for you and we will help you. And we did. We stayed with him every step of the way. And I remember going into him on February 27th and I said, Dad, it's time for you to go. I want you to go be with Mom, be with your brothers, and be with your sisters. You've done a terrific job here, and it's time for you to go. We love you. Within 30 seconds, he passed. He was waiting for me to give him the okay, because that's how close we were. And we were all there to watch him take his last breath. If you want to talk about a gift, boy, the biggest one I ever got. And what I thought was going to be a very trying experience turned out to be one of the most beautiful experiences that I'll ever have the opportunity to go through. So I want to thank you guys, to thank Amanda for inviting me to speak today, and God bless.
All right, thank you. Now we have Chris and Samantha for festivities.